supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. As families affected by the earthquake in Mexico continue to grieve the loss of loved ones and search for survivors, a church in Norristown is holding a mass and relief drive for the victims of that disaster and Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. WHYY's Avi Wolfman Aaron joins me live from St. Patrick's Church in Norristown. Avi, describe the scene.
Hey, Dave. Services are just getting underway here. People are streaming into St. Patrick's, and I think there's just a sense of tension. So many people here just don't know what's happened to their family members in Mexico or Puerto Rico, and there's that nervousness that comes from not knowing, and that's sort of the feeling you get. People, of course, look a little down, a little glum, and I think a lot of folks here are here to almost distract themselves or to feel like they're doing something when they are, in a lot of ways, quite powerless.
Avi, have you had the opportunity to speak with anyone who's been personally affected by either Maria or the earthquake in Mexico?
I have. In fact, I spoke with a woman, Milagros Rivera, who's been affected by both disasters. Her husband is from Mexico, a part of Mexico that was deeply affected by the earthquake, and he is there right now. She has not heard from him. She also has a lot of family in Puerto Rico, which is where she's from. She's been here since she was nine, but she has a lot of family in Puerto Rico, and she told me that they're spread out all over the island.
I'm worried about my grandkids, my family, and my grandparents.
For her, she said that in particular, a lot of her family is in a community right on the water. Sort of the word from talking, especially with Puerto Rican members of this parish, is that there's just no word out of Puerto Rico at this point. They have no idea what's happened to their families' property in that country. And there's, when you think about sort of where the Latino diaspora is located around the hemisphere, so many of these families have been in the crosshairs of multiple natural disasters now. Milagros Rivera has three sons in Florida. They were in the path of Hurricane Irma. Talked to another man named Cruz Fuentes. He is from Puerto Rico. He has a brother also in Tampa, and he has other family in Houston. This has been sort of hit after hit after hit. And there's a feeling of desperation and exasperation. The man I talked to, Cruz Fuentes, said he usually does about one or two Sudoku puzzles a day to distract his mind. He's been doing 10 or 15 a day because he just hasn't heard anything from his family in Puerto Rico, and he doesn't know what to do to stop thinking about it. This is a really interesting parish here in Norristown. It used to be an all-Irish Catholic parish, and the Father Gus Paleo, who now leads the parish here, told me that there's been a huge growth in the parish over the last 20 years as Latinos have moved to Norristown, and many of them have been deeply affected by this crisis. About 70% of the parish is from Mexico, specifically the part of Mexico that was most affected by the earthquake this week. He told me one story of a man who was awaiting word from his grandchildren in Mexico.
He had two grandsons. One kid comes home from school, and the other one went to another school. And somebody went to pick him up. He didn't hear for hours for them. And they thought, oh, my goodness, right? Because during the time they were in school, the earthquake happened. And so when they finally got home, they felt better, but they were really nervous.
WHYY's Avi Wolfman Aaron reporting live from St. Patrick's Church in Norristown. In other news this evening, the Department of Homeland Security is looking to hire 15,000 new employees focused on border security and immigration enforcement. And today, representatives from Federal Border Patrol were in Philadelphia seeking qualified candidates. As WHYY's Laura Benshoff reports, there were some job seekers you might not expect.
When I get to the bustling job fair on the second floor of Temple University's Student Center, Agent Langione Molina stands behind a folding table decked out with green Border Patrol swag. He's giving two people his pitch in Spanish. These Colombian exchange students don't qualify to work in federal law enforcement, but they take pamphlets and put their names down anyway. Molina tells them that he himself is Dominican, but has U.S. citizenship. In order to deport more undocumented immigrants from near the U.S. border and within the rest of the country, the Trump administration called for a massive hiring effort earlier this year. But a report this summer from the Department of Homeland Security's Inspector General, a kind of watchdog, highlighted some challenges. It found the process can take a long time and that the numbers of Border Patrol agents have been going down since 2011. U.S. Customs and Border Protection didn't respond to requests for official comment, so it's not clear how the new push is going. At this event, job seekers who approach Molina mostly fall into two categories, either young and unfocused or military veterans looking for jobs away from the action. Veteran Curtis Keyes served in the military during the 1990s and now works in human resources.
You know, I'm a little long in the tooth to be doing Border Patrol and things of that nature.
Temple student Rashid Harrison says he is interested in Border Patrol, but the agency has some competition.
I have a few applications here from other places as well. I also picked up from Ally Universal. It's actually a security company.
Or, he says, maybe he'll go into finance and leave law enforcement to someone else. Laura Benshoff, WHYY News.
WHYY is among 12 nonprofit and for-profit companies divvying up $1 million in grants announced today by the Lenfest Institute for Journalism. Let's take a closer look with Kristen Hare. She covers local news innovation for the Poynter Institute, and that's a position also funded by the Knight Lenfest Newsroom Initiative. Kristen, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for having me.
It's a changing landscape. Let's first talk about the Lenfest Institute and its mission.
Lenfest was set up as a nonprofit to put the ownership of Philadelphia Media Network into nonprofit hands and make sure that it stays stable. We have a similar situation where I work at the Poynter Institute. Poynter was founded to be the nonprofit owner of the Tampa Bay Times. But the difference, I think, is Lenfest is really interested in funding innovation and sustainability for local news. And Poynter, we are more in the business of educating journalists and the public about journalism.
Actually, it is a total of $2 million in grants announced today. $1 million will go to PMN, again, the parent company of the Inquirer, Daily News, and Philly.com. How will those monies be divvied?
PMN has a lot of projects that they've planned for this. They include increasing their investigative team from 7 people to 11. They're increasing consumer health care coverage. They're working with the American Society of Newspaper Editors for an in-house leadership program. They're launching a 2-year newsroom fellowship program focused on diversity and mentorship. And they're launching a project with Harkin for audience engagement.
You're using descriptors like launching, investing, increasing in media in a time where we see so much retrenchment, especially in print media.
The thing that this money does is starting to help those newsrooms build some runway, to experiment with things that will work. And if all you're doing is cutting and cutting and cutting, you can't grow. This is the kind of thing that has a lot of potential.
But the cutting was done to maintain the profit structure. And so how can one grow and invest and still stay solvent?
So the thing that I've seen a lot of newsrooms around the country doing is diversifying their revenue streams. The smart thing that I've seen at PMN so far is they've put up a metered paywall. Now, if you're used to getting your news for free there, you might not like that. But what that's forcing them to do is to not focus on how many clicks can we get, but how can we create journalism that people think is so good they're willing to pay for it? And it results in a different kind of journalism. Memberships are a big thing, for-profit and nonprofit partnerships. The challenge is that we have this old model, right, the ad model, that still makes the most money, the old print ad model. And so I think what newsrooms need the most right now is a bridge to help them get over depending on that model and finding something or many things that work in its stead.
So now let's apply these concepts to WHYY. We are receiving monies for, I believe, three different ventures. Let's take them in turn. First, the Center for Investigative Reporting.
Center for Investigative Reporting has done great work with newsrooms around the country. They're particularly interested in engagement and taking the news that matters to people off of the screen or the page or out of your earbuds or your radio and bringing it to, you know, sort of to you in person. So that's going to be a really great partnership to see between those two.
What's the focus of Philadelphia Solutions journalism?
You know, you see those these big investigations come out, and I think a lot of times what you may be feeling when you finish is, well, everything is awful and there's nothing we can do about it. What Solutions Journalism does is they do those investigations with very clear eyes, but they try to end or to weave into them things that are working in other places. It's taking the next logical step from reporting and offering solutions to a community that often leans to impact.
Sandra Clark is our Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue, and she's the project lead on creating culturally competent newsrooms. How would you describe that venture?
It's going to involve teaching members of the community to tell their own stories and having those communities explain themselves and help train journalists in understanding what those communities are. I think that's a terrific thing to not just be able to listen to your audience and to empower them, but to see where they're coming from so that you as a reporter, especially if you're not from that community, aren't walking in there with a set of assumptions that are wrong.
Thank you for offering a sense of perspective and optimism to our conversation.
Of course.
Kristen Hare covers local news innovation for the Poynter Institute. It's a position also funded by the Knight Lenfest Newsroom Initiative. Hotels around the country are increasingly replacing staff with apps and mobile devices. And in the face of automation, there's one group of elite concierges fighting to preserve their role in the industry. WHYY's Bobby Allen spent time with a Philadelphia member of the group and offers this report.
Jeannie Green from the Denver area works in marketing. She's in Philadelphia at least once a month for work, and often she'll stay at the Sonesta Hotel in Rittenhouse, where she was in the lobby recently looking at the Open Tables app on her phone.
I select dinner tonight, and I kind of just, you know, scroll of what's available for the area and where I see 4.5 stars.
Travelers like Green who rely on apps for local recommendations have become the norm. And it's sent jitters through the profession of concierges, the friendly hotel staffers who have spent their careers providing a service that may now seem obsolete. In New York, a hotel recently opened where guests check in and pick up their keys by tapping a tablet. Want to call room service? You'll have to send a Facebook message to a chat bot. Does this all spell the end for concierges? Jack Nargill of the exclusive concierge group, the Society of Golden Keys, says no way.
We're human beings. We are the people who know our cities the best. No app, no internet can ever replace us.
But they're starting to. According to the American Hotel and Lodging Association, the number of luxury hotels with concierges has dropped nearly 20% over the last 2 years. The Society of Golden Keys is responding. It represents some of the most rigorously trained concierges in the world. They wear cross golden key pins on their lapels. The concierges in the murder mystery film, The Grand Budapest Hotel, were fictional members of this fraternity. They've started an awareness program to market the value of human contact. Here's the group's president, Robert Marks.
More and more people are so tired of looking down at their laptops and their iPads and their iPhones, that they actually are enjoying the human one-on-one interaction and the eye contact and actually having someone that takes a true vested interest in their well-being and their needs.
Recently, the group met in Washington to discuss ways of staying relevant in 2017. They discussed how apps are not the enemy. Travelers feel overwhelmed with options, and so concierges need to be more upfront about their role. As Marx put it, like purifiers of information. Instead of you approaching them, they may approach you, perhaps holding an iPad.
Before, they used to be behind these imposing marble desks that look like altars and that were very intimidating for some guests. Now you're going to find the concierge a little more involved in the throughout the hotel.
Another thing they're doing, promoting concierge success stories. Like when a bride found out on the day of her wedding that her dress was trapped at the dry cleaners. She was frantic. Marks offered to take her shopping or find her another dress.
None of those were options she was willing to accept.
So he found the number of the security company monitoring the store. contacted them and got the number of the owner, who unlocked the shop and handed him the dress.
So, crisis averted, happy bride.
Bjorn Hansen has heard many concierge stories like the happy bride one. He's a professor at New York University's hospitality program. He says concierges do things no app can do, but he expects technology to continue to force layoffs. But he doesn't think their extinction is imminent.
And it may be that instead of three shifts a day, it's two shifts a day, or instead of two shifts a day, it's one.
Back at the Sonesta near Rittenhouse Square, concierge Fran Nachman says she has the inside track at many hotels in the city. She has a jam-packed Rolodex to prove it.
Sometimes I have to just look through to find one that maybe is should be tossed, so I have my blank to use again.
There's not even room to squeeze in another card. And she has other thick binders of contacts. Say a guest wants a steak dinner.
I have my menu book, and I have a section that has steak. We've got chops, we've got Octavio's, we've got Fogo, Morton's, prime rib, urban farmer.
All the menus in one place with Neckman's own tips. Maybe you can get some of that on OpenTable, but she says getting the hookup, that's harder to do with an app.
Calling the restaurant manager and saying, can you squeeze somebody in? If you can't do it at 7:30, can you do it at 8?
If your app shows it's not available, Nachman says, let me see what I can do. Sometimes she says, working the phones can make magic happen. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
The U.S. criminal justice system functions to exclude black people from full political participation, and merely reforming the current system is an inadequate approach to achieving fundamental change. That's a contention put forth in Democratizing Criminal Law as an Abolitionist Project, a recently published article in the Northwestern Law Review. Joining me in conversation is the author, Dorothy Roberts, professor of law, sociology, and Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Roberts, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you for inviting me.
And this paper is a synthesis of decades of work on these topics. So, in the broadest sense, how is it that black people are excluded from political participation in the criminal justice process?
Well, my argument is that criminal law actually excludes black people from political participation in the United States. That's one of its functions from the very beginning. And many, many different aspects of the criminal justice system achieve this.
In a combination of overt and covert means?
Both overt and covert. So there are very direct forms of exclusion, like felon disenfranchisement, that prohibits people who have been convicted of felonies from voting, in addition to not being able to vote while you're actually behind bars. There's also very direct ways in which black people are prevented from political participation when they're arrested for petty offenses, discriminatorily targeted by police, and then incarcerated, sometimes incarcerated for a long time without even being adjudicated.
What are some examples of those petty offenses?
Oh, for example, sitting in a car without your seatbelt on, or drinking in public, spitting in public, playing music too loudly. Ferguson, for example, revealed that the citizens there were routinely stopped for very minor traffic offenses and then fined in ways that they couldn't pay back, kept in jail when they couldn't pay fines. People lost their jobs, lost their children over these very, very minor offenses that they were deliberately targeted for in order to raise money for the municipality. So this kind of police action that is targeted at black communities for minor offenses can have really devastating consequences for entire neighborhoods.
But whether it's at the point of arrest of a suspect or the bail system or the criminal justice system that determines incarceration duration, why is each piece of that process impervious to reform, as you cite in your article?
What I'm arguing is we have to have an approach to the criminal justice system that doesn't see it as just a problem of procedure that needs to be fixed. We can't see the system as a system that just isn't working quite right, so we need to tweak it. or a system that is designed to be democratic, so we just need to include more people in it. My argument is that it is a system that is designed to control and monitor and exclude from political participation Black people, whole Black communities. And therefore, we have to, in order to democratize the system, dismantle these types of procedures that are geared toward an anti-democratic function.
Hence the term abolitionist project. Abolition, to formally put an end to a system, practice, or institution. If this system that you are decrying is abolished, what is it replaced with?
I've argued that we need to eliminate these anti-democratic functions of the criminal law, and that does lead to the very good question, what do we replace it with? So how do we get to actually a system that is designed to protect people, and to all people, and to help people flourish, that to have a democratic relationship between people and government? And in order to do that, we have to have a mindset, a framework, an approach that says we need to end the anti-democratic, racist way that we're, this country is implementing criminal law today, and move toward a vision of a humane, equal, just way of dealing with social harms. What would be effective? What kinds of policies would be effective? And that's what I, and I believe many others, mean by abolition.
Professor, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you so much.
Dorothy Roberts, professor of law, sociology, and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania, and author of Democratizing Criminal Law as an Abolitionist Project. It's a recently published article in the Northwestern Law Review. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.